I'm Carrie Thompson, and I wouldn't be snooping through the freezing cold storage of the NPR archives if it weren't for all the great stories I keep finding from 25 years ago. In this month's playback, we feature some soul-searching from former First Lady Betty Ford.
It took a while for me to realize that as far as alcohol and drugs were concerned, they were not for me.
And in this special substance abuse edition of Playback, the Judd sisters, Winona and Naomi, reveal how they got hooked on country music.
You know, people try and go back to the very minute when I became, you know, addicted to music. It happened over literally a 9 or 10 year period.
So what's 10 years among friends? Also in this playback, some sad words from a helpless husband left to fend for himself when his wife goes out of town.
Last minute instructions included how to make coffee. Unnecessary. I would simply reheat the same pot each day, which I did.
It sure doesn't get much better than that. First up, the Singing Bobs, with Bob Edwards on Morning Edition.
I've got all the Bobs.
You've got them all.
Every one of them.
Every single one of them.
Hi, this is Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
How are you? You guys ready?
Yeah.
Yes, folks, they're back. The Bobs. You see, music is no longer enough for the Bobs, so today we introduce them in their new role as musical commentators. Like our other commentators, the Bobs will be addressing the issues of the day, the things that have true impact on our lives, matters such as paper versus plastic.
Let's see now. I think that's everything. I got a bunch of bananas and a bottle of bleach. 5 cans of cat food, a chicken and a peach. I had enough trouble picking out all this food. I can't stand decisions, I think it's so rude that you ask me if I want plastic or paper. I don't know. Just a bag. Oh, plastic sounds okay. Just put it in the bag and let me go home.
Paper.
Oh, well, maybe paper's better. I don't know how to make a decision about this. Well, then the clerk, he says to me, he says, Mr. Consumer, please pause to reflect. The choice that you make can have a global effect on lumberjacks and turtles, politicians and fish. Would you like a paper bag? Is that your wish? On the other hand, I offer a bag that won't leak. And besides, it's got handles. Plastic! Well, okay, give me a plastic bag. Make it a plastic one.
That's the Bobs. Asking the question that just does not seem to go away.
Maybe a paper bag! Oh, yeah.
And now, here's our esteemed colleague, Susan Stamberg, with a very special guest.
It was a busy week for the president. Mr. Reagan not only had to defend his own actions in the Iran arms deal, he also came to the defense of his wife, Nancy. Lots of reports lately that the First Lady was directly involved in a number of policy decisions being made at the White House, and she forced the resignation of Donald Reagan as chief of staff. On the Reagan's 35th wedding anniversary last Tuesday, at a photo session, the president gave an impromptu defense of his wife.
But the idea that she's involved in governmental decisions and so forth and all of this, and being a kind of a dragon lady, there is nothing to that. And no one who knows her well would ever believe it.
Betty Ford was First Lady for almost 2.5 years in the 1970s. She was in Washington this past Thursday and stopped by our studio to talk, mostly about her life and her battles with drugs and alcohol. But the role of the First Lady is so much in the news these days that I just couldn't resist asking for Mrs. Ford's reaction to Nancy Reagan and how she is standing by her husband.
I think a First Lady, her primary, foremost job is to be a support system for her husband in a, you know, very powerful position, and probably it is the most important position in the world. She has done that, and she's done it with great zest and perhaps more colorfully than some other first ladies. But I admire her for that, and I have great sympathy for anyone who's living in the White House. I know what a fishbowl it can be. I know how hard it was on our children because some of them were living there. And there's just no private life, and the people out there, you're bound to have supporters, and you're bound to have those that are going to criticize, and people are going to find fault with you. You have to have confidence in what you and your husband are doing, and you've got to give him that confidence. And I admire her for giving him the support and confidence that he is foremost and he's right. And I think she's done that. I also think there's been a lot of unfair criticism about how perhaps she's the power behind the throne. I really don't believe that. I think that Ronald Reagan is very much in charge, and just as marriage is different, she may have more input than some other wife. President Reagan, of course, has been an older president Sure. in some cases, and we have to take that into consideration. But he was elected by the people. That's who they wanted, and they should have had that into consideration in their thoughts at that time.
They knew what they were getting.
Absolutely.
Susan continued her conversation later in the hour and brought up the subject of Betty Ford's alcohol and drug abuse problems.
It took a while for me to realize that, yes, as far as alcohol and drugs were concerned, they were not for me, and that I would be able to live the rest of my life drug-free, alcohol-free, if I didn't address it as the rest of my life, and I only took it just a day at a time.
Betty Ford has been taking her life one day at a time now for 8 years, since she faced up to her addiction to alcohol and drugs. The fact that this former First Lady is open about such a problem is no surprise to those who remember her in the White House, always outspoken, always willing to take a risk. Betty Ford told the world about her mastectomy. She spoke out for the Equal Rights Amendment, for legalized abortion. And now, in a new book written with Chris Chase, Betty Ford confronts the most difficult and painful period of her life. On Thursday, Betty Ford came here to Studio 3 and sat and talked. She said she's still bothered by arthritis and a pinched nerve, but she no longer takes the addictive pain medicines that her doctors once prescribed. Instead, Betty Ford uses moist heat, acupuncture, sometimes a corset-like brace, and a new day-at-a-time attitude toward life.
I live my life in balance that way by not getting too excited about anything or too stressed over anything. I have a good schedule. I stick with that schedule. If I get preoccupied with what's happening tomorrow or how maybe I failed yesterday, then my life gets out of balance. So I focus with the help of my higher power, whom I choose to call God, in knowing that today, this day, I will get through. And I'll worry about tomorrow when it comes.
You know, Mrs. Ford, that's a wonderful prescription for life. You don't have to be
I believe
recovering
that.
From Yeah.
But I didn't know that before, mm-hmm. and I do now.
I went into our tape archives and found some fragments of tape I would like to play for you now. This was broadcast on September 4th, 1974.
Thank you very much. Won't you all be seated? It's nice to see so many good friends here. I'm sure you all know that this is my first experience is giving a press conference, but I feel I know you all so well that I thought it would be a very comfortable way to do it and a way that we could all get together and one time and not take up individual's time.
That was a very scary moment in my life.
You laughed when you heard it. I liked watching your face. As you
were. Yes, because I did know all the people in the press, and they were our friends. We'd lived in Washington for 25 years, but this was a new experience to address them as the First Lady of the land.
It was a month after Richard Nixon's resignation, and there you were. Who was that Betty Ford? Frightened apart from that, but how far were you in the drug problems or the alcohol problems at that point?
I don't think I was thinking too much about my back or those things. So those pains were secondary to the pain that was probably trying to fulfill a role that I respected tremendously and to be a good wife and mother and first lady. Certainly that was a big requirement to me because I respect our country so.
Mm-hmm. You're right. That those White House years were very good ones for you in terms of pushing aside those addiction problems.
I suddenly was somebody. I wasn't just the suburban housewife who was taking care of the children and being the backup to this man who was out front. Not only that, but he was there. He was there every night. His office was, you know, only hundreds of yards away as compared to when we lived in Virginia, all the way into the Capitol. So I felt a part of it. He was no longer traveling. That was a very fulfilling time in spite of the pain. I certainly wasn't drinking to any extent because other than, you know, very simple cocktail or glass of wine or something like that, because schedule-wise, there really wasn't time for letting down and doing that sort of thing. I did drink alone before that when I was at home in the evening. Once I got my children settled and they did their homework and I had their dinner, and I would feel that I had fulfilled my day and I needed some time to relax, and I'd watch television mm-hmm. and have a mm-hmm. drink and mm-hmm. go to bed on a drink.
And it really wasn't until after you left the White House and moved out to California that the problem started. You, in a way, you say your life fell apart. You didn't know who you were anymore. The kids weren't home. Your husband was out traveling. I wonder about this, Mrs. Ford. And forgive the question, but I really feel I must ask it. Did you never come to blame him?
I wasn't blaming him as much as I was feeling resentment for my role, because I'd been a very independent person. But my problem was, in true alcoholic style, I was stuffing it down and coping in other ways with pills, and probably the alcohol was something that for the moment it made everything seem comfortable. It was more like a crutch or a security blanket.
There's a story in your book that's really my favorite story because I think it's most revealing about you, about being in Detroit in 1980 for the Republican convention, one of those tall glass tower hotels. Can you tell the rest of the story? The management called up from downstairs.
Well, we had a terrible storm going on, and it was the sky was black, and it was very exciting, and I was caught up in all of it. But we were in rooms that were glass from ceiling to floor, and we were very high on the 32nd floor, I believe. And they told us to stay away from the windows because the wind, some of them could have shattered. But I had to first just get over and get close as I possibly could to get a good look. You know, I really think of myself as liking to get out there and experience things and feel them. You might say I'm sort of a risk taker.
Mrs. Ford, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been delightful talking to you today. Don't push me, 'cause
I'm close to the edge. Former First Lady Betty Ford, living life on the edge. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front. Poor commentator Jeff O'Brien had some personal obstacles to overcome when his wife went out of town.
I can't cook. My family knows this. The children still talk about the hamburgers I reduced to carbonized Worcestershire discs. They won't even touch my toast. So when the wife prepared to attend a 4-day convention, she assigned meals to the daughter. It would be her first time away from her family in 17 years. She seemed convinced we would not survive. Duty lists she compiled and put them on our placemats, briefing each of us to ensure compliance. My responsibilities were simple. Keep the bills in one pile. I vowed to prove myself worthy of such trust. Last-minute instructions included how to make coffee. Unnecessary. I would simply reheat the same pot each day, which I did. By the fourth day, it tasted incredibly like my hamburgers. "Don't worry, we'll be fine," we bubbled in a pretentious display of social harmony. I even promised to keep a journal in her absence. This was a wonderful idea. Not only could she catch up on our lives upon her return, but it also could serve me as a memory aid during official inquiries. Monday afternoon, she left. I read from the journal. Monday evening. The boy picks at his salad and pizza with his free hand. The other one is handcuffed to his ankle. Trying for the proper tone, I tell him he must remain at the table until he finishes his supper, or at least until the ball game comes on. He rolls on the floor and informs me he knows the three island countries of Europe. Tuesday. All day at work, I can't remember if I turned off the stove under my pan of coffee. In the 45 minutes from the time he walked in the back door until I telephoned, the boy claims to have fed the animals, completed his homework, and practiced his saxophone. Is this possible? I pick up the girl from play practice. The sultry vapors of fast food coat the car windows. Wednesday. He calls me at the office. Can he ride his bike down the highway and play in a derelict sawmill? His mom let him do it before, he says. So much happens I know nothing about. I have this vision of him in an ambulance. I pick up the girl after cheerleading practice. She got a 98 in biology. The boy lives. In a microwave, she heats a block of frozen spaghetti. 15 minutes and probably $20 worth of electricity later, she breaks it up with a fork and serves iced pasta. We feast on Pop-Tarts and generic corn chips. He says he does his homework in school. I study him carefully. He looks as well scrubbed as a mule skinner. I order a bath and make an enemy. I read an article on parenting in McCall's. Thursday. She'll be back today. Making one final pass through the house before going to work, I smooth bedspreads, wipe countertops, stack books and magazines, pick up socks, and add to the twin peaks of clothes in the utility tubs. On an end table, I find potting soil where a plant has been uprighted. Behind the chair, I find the football. In their open bag, I find pretzels going soft. Surely there are other disasters invisible to my untrained eye, but we're late. I grab my briefcase and charge out the door to face the complications of the world. The first one is, who sits up front on the way to the bus stop? Walking through the yard that evening, my spirits lifted. The sky had cleared, and the house and barn were awash in golden light. A warm breeze rose in the west. Sparrows twittered in the pines. Through the screen drifted the comforting vibrations of the washing machine. Balance had returned to the universe, and I realized at that moment I should have kept the bills together. Oh, such are
the dreams of the everyday housewife. Yeah, and one other mistake. He shouldn't have called his wife the wife. An everyday housewife who gave up the good life for me. Talented performer Danny Kaye passed away in March 87. Here's NPR's Bob Mondello with an appreciation.
You remember him for his smile, which gave shape to a face that sometimes seemed to be made of elastic. Actually, everything about Danny Kaye seemed flexible. His hands floated independently when he spoke. His mop of red hair flew in all directions. His eyes danced. He could be anything and anybody, from Walter Mitty to Captain Hook. You can actually date Kaye's rise to stardom. It happened on January 23, 1941, opening night of a new Broadway musical called Lady in the Dark. He stopped the show cold with a patter song called Tchaikovsky, in which he recited the unpronounceable names of 54 Russian composers in 38 seconds. As he told NPR's Jay Kernis 2 years ago, he could even do it in 31.
Now, 31 seconds is easy to do when you have a microphone. But in a theater, by the time it gets halfway into the house, the faster you do it, the more jumbled it becomes. somebody said to me, can you still do it? And I said, yeah, it's very simple.
You try every now and then?
No. You see, he's a very clever young man. He said, do I try now and then? You know, with this ingenuous kind of attitude, hoping I would say, well, of course, there's Malachevsky, Rubinstein, Adensky, and Chekhovsky.
There's Malachevsky, Rubinstein, Adensky, and Chekhovsky, Sapelnikov, Dmitriev, Cherepin, Krizhinovsky, Kodovsky, Atobuchev, Moni, Yusko, Akimenko, Soloviev, Prokofiev, Tiyamkin, Goroshenko, there's Glinkla, Winkla...
Kay's life sometimes seemed to be playing at Fast Forward. He did everything. He starred in 17 movies, countless television specials, several Broadway shows. With partners, he owned a Major League Baseball team, the Seattle Mariners. He was a 5-handicap golfer, a regular on best dressed lists, and though he couldn't read a note of music, he conducted most of the great orchestras of the world, with proceeds going to musicians' pension funds. Of course, he had his own style of conducting. He once led the Cleveland Symphony in Flight of the Bumblebee, using a fly swatter for his baton. Some critics said Kay could never be a good straight comedian because he couldn't work with partners. His life partner, wife Sylvia Fine, who wrote most of his best patter songs, is living proof that that isn't entirely true. But what the critics meant was that Kay was a solitary clown. Like the other great vaudevillians, he was a lovable freak of nature who needed room to improvise, to go his own way. And that sometimes got him into trouble. When he returned to Broadway after a 30-year absence in a musical called 2x2, an injury had him performing on crutches for 10 months. Soon he was riding around stage in a wheelchair, trying to run down the other actors. He began improvising his own lines. The audience loved it, but among theater professionals, he got a reputation for lacking discipline.
Having been a solo performer most of my life, I got to feel like I was bandaged. Night after night after night, to have to say exactly the same thing at the same time, in the same way, and I found that it used to slightly stifle whatever inventiveness I may have been feeling at the moment.
I'm frisky as a pup. Hey, Esther, hurry up! I feel like I'm 90 again.
But most of all, Kay will be remembered for his love of children, which was as genuine as it was boundless. When he dined with friends and their kids, he barely even spoke to the friends. He could become totally absorbed in the world of children. All over the world, he could speak their language, and if he couldn't, he could make up a language they could all speak together. He spent 33 years as roving ambassador for UNICEF, the UN organization that helps needy children. And, appropriately, the movie role for which he'll be best remembered is Hans Christian Andersen. Danny Kay was a crazy, a loon of the first magnitude, a sublime clown who had a talent for youth.
And now, Noah Adams chats with the Judds. You know, the singing Judds.
These singers usually have a song pretty close to the top of the charts. And last week, they picked up their third Grammy Award in Los Angeles. It's always interesting to see them on television, to try to figure out which one is the mother and which one is the daughter. The mother is Naomi Judd. The daughter is Winona.
When I say I want you, when I say I need you, why don't you believe me? When I say I miss you, when I'm not there with you, why don't you believe me? True love is so hard to find. Why are you running away?
The music of the Judds. The daughter usually sings lead, the mother sings the harmony. They came together from Kentucky to Nashville about 10 years ago, working hard to make it in music, and they did. It had been tough, though, before that, the years when Naomi Judd, after several years of trying out careers, enrolled in nursing school.
At this point, I didn't have any money, you know, and I go down to the little music store and have to buy our records in the discount bin, and I get bluegrass records. Mm-hmm. So we discovered Hazel and Alice. They were $1.99, and I couldn't afford...
Hazel Gerard and Alice Dickens.
Absolutely. Yeah, on Rounder Records.
No, I got that wrong. Alice Gerard and Hazel Dickens.
It's Alice Gerard and Hazel Dickens, and they're two of our idols.
So you were listening to bluegrass and other songs, but could you have... Were you making a professional decision, picking out a sort of music that you thought, perhaps, or you had a dream, perhaps, that you could make a living in.
Great googly moogly no. Wynonna and I evolved so naturally and so spontaneously. People have asked us if there was ever a moment that we went, great, the light bulb just went off. We'll be country singers. And mm-hmm. There is no time.
You know, people try to and go back to the very minute when I became, you know, addicted to music. It happened over literally a 9 or 10 year period. When we were living in Kentucky, Mama, and that's why I think, our background, our people spent their lives, I mean, they were born, they work, no raises, no extras, and then they die. And I think, Mom, we are the first Judds to get out of that had the dream and the nerve, I guess, to be poor but fulfill a fantasy. I think, you know, Mama's dad, our Papal Judd, used to think, she is out to lunch. I mean, what is she doing? She's got two kids. When she could be a nurse making, you know, $7 or $8 an hour, she could be married and have security, you know, and all the while Mama kept saying, Daddy, I just want something different. You know, I want to see what's on the other side of that mountain.
I know where I'm going. Don't you want to come too? I got my reservations and I got one for you. I know why I'm singing. Don't you want to sing too? Can't you hear the bells are ringing? Spirit move you, yeah.
It was singing with Wynonna that became a way of communication. And that's what music meant to us in those early days. It was definitely not, it wasn't a cultural event. It wasn't something that we were honing to earn money at or anything like that. It was simply a desperate attempt from both of us to reach out and communicate with each other because we had such emotional struggles.
Well, there was a time when she would come into the room and she was the neurotic, dramatic Naomi Judd of life. And there would be times when I didn't understand her as a person, maybe I didn't love her as my mother, but she would come in and say, hey, I just wrote this new song, or I bought you a new Hazel and Alice, record today. Let's learn a song.
Well, Donna, when did you realize that you were good, that you had a great talent? And when, Naomi, when did you think about it?
You know, an interesting story that no one knows. When we first got to Nashville, we'd been singing together at home. But I was so steeped in this idea of becoming a nurse midwife or going on to get an MD that I was thinking of Wynonna. You know, the kid never talked about college or career or any of that normal stuff.
Her responsibility.
So it had become obvious to me that she was going to get into music one way or the other. But we got the Leah Jane Singers, who are probably the best backup singers in the business. I got them to back Wynonna, and we cut a little demo on her. And I took it to the biggest producers in Nashville, and nobody was interested. But then I had this little tape of Wynonna and I singing together, the two voices, and absolute magic happened.
When you listen to this new album, those songs on there, her harmony is so wonderful. I don't know where she comes up with it. I mean, we go in the studio, and Brent Mayer, our producer, and Don Potter, who we call the third Judd.
He's the bass player.
Yeah, no, he's the guitar player. He's the every lick that you hear acoustically is him. They sit there and go, Naomi Judd, where do you get these, you know, notes? Where do you come up with, I think it's, as I joke and say, the blood thing. Together, that's when it's magic.
Wynonna Judd and her mother, Naomi. Their latest album is called Heartland.
Some call it country with a little bit of rhythm and blues. And when the boys start rocking, there's a beat that you just can't lose.
That's it for Playback. Next month, join us as we discover what's really made in the USA. And we'll visit with some of the last survivors of the Titanic. Really live and in person. Well, live 25 years ago.
I love the slide of a steel guitar. I love the moan of an old blues heart.
I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.
I love the shade.